Case number 20-6002, Jessica Barefield et al. V. Jacqueline Hillman et al. Oral arguments not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Ms. Stephanie A. Bergmeier for the appellants.
May I proceed?
Yes, Your Honor. I have reserved 2 minutes for rebuttal in this case.
Okay.
The defendants, Ms. Jackie Hillman and Ms. Beverly Normet, respectfully ask this court to reverse the district court's ruling denying qualified immunity on the state-created danger claim. This court has two different paths to find that qualified immunity applies. First, that the defendants did not violate due process rights under the state-created danger theory. And second, that the rights here were not clearly established. The first, the defendants did not violate a right to be free from state-created danger.
Counsel, can I ask you a threshold question? I don't mean to throw you off. I want to make sure. I think there were maybe two issues you lost on below, and both of those were mentioned in the notice of appeal, one being the AAA issue, and then the other issue, which I think most of the briefing was addressed at. Is there really only one issue before us, only one substantive claim before us?
Yes, Your Honor. The only issue before the court is on the substantive due process state-created danger theory.
Okay. So the other claim is still in the district court, presumably will head, whatever happens here will go forward potentially to trial.
Yes, Your Honor. The general rule is that a failure to protect a person against private violence does not constitute a constitutional violation. In limited circumstances, this court has recognized the state-created danger theory of liability. There must be, in this limited circumstance, an affirmative act by the state that, or by the defendant, that either created or increased the risk that the plaintiff would be exposed to third-party violence. In other words, this court will look to whether the plaintiff was safer before the state action than he was after it in this case. One example of this is in the Cartwright case that we cited in our brief. In that case, police officers took an intoxicated plaintiff from the side of a highway and dropped him off at a convenience center. This court concluded that the officers took him from a place of great danger to a place of lesser danger. Likewise here, the plaintiff was on the run prior to the state action and had been living on the streets for approximately 1 week. He returned to state custody. The defendants placed him in a level one foster home. They took the child from a place of great danger being on the streets to a place of lesser danger. And so placement of the child at this foster home did not create or increase a risk of violence by a private actor.
So your friend, counsel, your friend on the other side might say that, well, that sort of ignores that initially the placement was in a level three facility, and then the next level placement was only level one. And so in one sense, that's not making things safer for TH, it's actually making them less safe.
And that is true, but all the facts in the record are that he was at the level three placement and he then ran away from the level three placement. So we need to look at where the child was before the state action, which here was placement in the foster home. And I would submit you can't ignore the fact that the child was on the run and had been in the streets. That's where he was before the state action. And according to the complaint, the amended complaint, it is undisputed and alleged by the plaintiff that he could not go back to that level three home and that there was a agency-wide problem with having enough beds available for kids in state custody. He doesn't allege an act of the defendants, but there was a statewide availability issue with having beds in these facilities. And so the defendant—
So he couldn't go back to level three because there was no room?
That is as alleged by the plaintiff in the amended complaint, which is document 27. And it's also undisputed that the foster home was a temporary placement until the agency could obtain a level three home. And that shortly within 1 month, they did find that placement and went to take him there when the child unfortunately ran away. And so you cannot ignore this undisputed fact that the child was on the streets, had run away from his level three placement, was gone for over a week. And when the child came back to state custody, the state action is putting him in a level one home, which is a safer place than he was before. Hillman's allegations focus on whether he should have been in a more secure facility, such as a level three facility. But it is clear under the case law that a failure to act does not constitute an affirmative act under the state created danger theory. The plaintiffs have failed to establish that there is an affirmative act here that increased or created a risk of harm to the child, and therefore they do not establish that there's been a violation of the child's substantive due process rights under the state created danger theory. Defendants can be entitled to qualified immunity on this ground alone. Now, this court could also find qualified immunity is appropriate here because any violation of a constitutional right was not clearly established. The plaintiff here must show that a reasonable official would have clearly understood that she was under an affirmative duty to refrain from such conduct. This is a fact-specific case-by-case determination.
So your friend on the other side says that Carlstrom versus City of Columbus is the case that sets forward the clearly established law here that was violated by your clients.
We would, although Carlstrom does establish the general theory of state-created danger was clearly established, but if you look at the facts, if you look by the facts in this case, it does not clearly fall under that, and Carlstrom would not have put the defendants here on notice that by putting this child in a foster home, that they were increasing or creating his risk to violate any constitutional right. In Carlstrom, in the Nelson case, the defendant's act substantially increased the plaintiff's vulnerability to private acts of violence. In Carlstrom, the court also noted that the private actors had no desire to harm the plaintiff before the state disclosed their identities. So the facts of those cases wouldn't have put the defendants on notice here that by putting the child in a foster home until a more secure facility could be obtained was violating that child's constitutional right.
How old was he?
Your Honor, I believe he was 13. He was either 13 or 14 years old.
And could they have just left him out on the street and said, we'll get in touch with you when there's a bed?
No, they could not have. He was placed in state custody as dependent and neglected. And so the state did have a duty to put him somewhere. And this was where he was placed.
But I'm asking, would it have been actionable, constitutionally actionable, had they not put him somewhere? I'm just trying to figure out where the before after breaks down. Could they have left him on his own and said, we'll get you when we have a space because we know you're going to run away anyway. And then how does your before after analysis work?
From a constitutional perspective, they could have done nothing. They were not creating or increasing any risk of harm by leaving him on the streets where he previously was, where he was before he came into state custody. So from a constitutional perspective, they could have done nothing. However, there are, of course, state duties with him being in state custody, state law obligations to do something with the child in custody and put them in a safe environment. So even under the Carlstrom case, the Nelson case, these other state-created danger theory of liability that were published cases in the district at the time, no reasonable official would conclude by putting the child in a foster home, they were making him less safe and violating his constitutional rights. Certainly, we submit the facts of this case are that reasonable officials could disagree on whether the conduct here violated any of the plaintiff's rights and qualified immunity applies. The defendants here have qualified immunity from plaintiff's state-created danger claim, and they respectfully ask this court to reverse the district court's ruling denying qualified immunity on this theory of liability. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, Mr. Downton.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. I'm Mark Downton, and I represent the plaintiffs and appellees in this case, Jessica Bearfield and her children. It pleased the court, for purposes of this appeal, it's undisputed that TH was in state custody at all times germane when all decisions to act or not act, however it needs to be framed, he was in state custody. Counsel for the defendants just said that. If I accomplish nothing else in this argument, I want to impress upon the court that this child was in state custody. And this fact must be dealt with in order to analyze any of the claims that are before the court. And it's for this reason that I submit to the court that all of TH's substantive due process rights need to be dealt with today. In the original claim, I made a state-created danger claim, but I also claimed that TH enjoyed a substantive due process right flowing from DeShaney, just like the state-created danger, under the 14th Amendment to be protected while in state custody. The district court disagreed with me and granted qualified immunity on that ground. The state has argued that that issue is not before the court because it was not a denial of qualified immunity and therefore can't get up here under the collateral order doctrine. However, because the underlying fact of state custody is so essential to both claims, to all of the claims in this case, these claims are inextricably intertwined and cannot be decided without deciding the others. For instance, under the state-created danger claim, the fact that he was in state custody, and Judge White just touched on this, affects the analysis of whether or not the state was creating dangers or enhancing his risk. It also affects the timeline. This did not happen in a vacuum. This is not like the Cartwright case, where the police had a very limited interaction with an adult and made one decision. This relationship went on for 9 months. Because the child was in state custody, the state stood in loco parentis. It was more than just a casual interaction. This is not a one-off. These decisions and actions extended over months and months and months. And because the state was in loco parentis, it's more than mere failures to act that we're talking about. It's acts of neglect. This child came into state custody for the very reasons that this child died, because he was on runaway often and because he was affiliating with gangs. They took this child away from his mother because that was neglect. It's an affirmative act of neglect when somebody acting as a parent doesn't address a child's needs. If you look at the whole timeline from October until this child's tragic death in June, you have a child that ran away from his first foster home, normal level one foster home, his second foster home, normal level one foster home, his third foster home. They did it again and again. Eventually, they put him in a level three and he stayed put for months and months. We know that was safer. Everybody acknowledges that was safer. Then when he came back, they put him back in a level one. Everybody acknowledges that that was riskier than the level three.
I guess the question, I guess, is what's the measuring stick? Is it the level three or is it from before he was in state custody at all?
Well, I believe it's the level three because that was the last action the state had taken with him in terms of his placement in loco parentis. They had placed him in a safer environment.
It just seems to me we usually look at this as pre-state custody to during state custody and compare the two. And unless the state has made things more dangerous, which I don't think is probably the case from a level one to not being in state custody, that to me is usually, I feel like that's usually the measuring stick, but you can tell me why that's.
Well, it is much more difficult because we have a relationship that extends 9 months. So that changes things. It's not just a casual interaction. You'll see all of the cases cited by defendant involve one-off interactions between officers, police officers, and adults. But I would argue that having a child in state custody for 9 months and allowing him to run away again and again and again does enhance his danger. He's getting older, he's getting bolder, he's getting smarter, he's learning how to do this, and it's going completely unaddressed.
Is that your failure to act claim, or is that your actions actually, I know you're saying you have two claims before us, I'm not sure that's quite right, but one involves action and one involves inaction.
Well, it's inaction.
You're mixing the two a bit.
It could be viewed as inaction if it was looked at as one-off events, but this was an ongoing relationship. Moreover, each one of these inactions, if you wanted to call it that, involve a corresponding action that the state took because he was in state custody. So failing to place him in a level three involved placing him somewhere else affirmatively. That happened. giving him treatment that did not address runaway involved an affirmative act of giving him treatment that involved something else that was not his issue. These things happen again and again and again. Making a plan for him that addressed only housing but did not address these other things was an affirmative act.
Those are you talking about, I'm having trouble, I think Judge Radler's too, about which claim are we talking about now? The state claim?
Yes, ma'am. What I'm really trying to illustrate is that the fact that he was in state custody underlies both of these claims. It shades the affirmative acts analysis because instead of being mere failures to act, they become acts of neglect. They become affirmative acts of neglect, just like if a parent was to do that to a child. For instance, failing to feed a child wouldn't just be a failure.
I'm sorry. One of the claims is basically you did something you shouldn't have done, and the other claim is you didn't do something. So those right, they do share the one fact involving, or arguably share the one fact involving custody, but the root of the claim is really pretty different, I think.
Well, a failure to protect can involve affirmative acts by the state to put the child at increased risk. They are not mutually exclusive. This court in Lippman versus Budish, which was decided late last year, it was largely a state-created danger case, but they addressed both the custody and special relationship test and the state-created danger case, didn't treat it as mutually exclusive ideas. And what has always happened in these cases is custody isn't defined by restricting his liberty. Custody is defined by simply placing him into custody. And we know that happened here. The district court clearly got that wrong on the failure to protect claim. We know this child was in custody at all times germane to this lawsuit. We know that that claim was wrong. If this court acknowledges that this child was in custody for purposes of analyzing the state-created danger claim, it must deal with the failure to protect claim. That's what I'm trying to make.
Well, may I ask you, what cases you think are most analogous to this one? I mean, this is a situation where this child affirmatively removed himself from every setting that the state had placed him in. And this seems to me somewhat analogous to the situation where the police picked up the individual, dropped him off at a safer place than he had been, but he removed himself to a more dangerous place. Do you have some cases that are really analogous to this situation?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, one big distinction there is that that was not a 13-year-old child. This is a 13-year-old child. And the state in this case did take him into custody. This child can't be trusted to make his own decisions. He is a child. That's the whole point of the state custody. That's a huge distinction. And it wasn't a one-off interaction. The case that's most directly-
Well, no matter what affirmative acts a child does, they don't count because the child is a child?
Not for a qualified immunity analysis, Your Honor. I would argue that certainly can go to causation.
What's the case that tells us that that's the clearly established law?
I would argue that Kallstrom sets forth the general reasoning that this court has
followed. Well, how about something more factually specific than Kallstrom that's more analogous to this case?
Lippman v. Budish involved social workers in a foster care context where they brought a child in and interviewed the child in front of its abusers again and again and again. That case put foster care workers on notice that their creation of dangers or enhancement of risk would result in a constitutional violation. That was just last year from this circuit. That case is probably most directly on point, but there's no getting around the idea that the state created danger, the general reasoning of the state created danger doctrine has been around for decades now. In fact, the Cheney itself, the godfather of all of these cases, set forth a couple of exceptions. One was in a foster care context, the state created danger claim, and the second was this failure to protect claim, where the kid's in custody and the state fails to protect the child while the child's in custody. So this Cheney starts it all, and that was back in the 1980s.
So you're saying, if I understand you, that as long as he was in state custody, really everything that happened was a state-created danger?
No. No, I'm not, Your Honor. I understand the difficulty. The state's actions and inactions, I believe, are acts of neglect because they were serving as his parent. And these needs were so apparent to the state. They were the very reasons he was in state custody. In fact, they were considered acts by his mother. That's how he got to be in state custody, because her inability to manage these behaviors were considered acts of neglect. Similarly, the state didn't do anything to manage these behaviors either and engaged in acts of neglect. But most importantly, let's talk about the final placement. That's the clearest. I believe that the entire course of conduct amounts to an act of neglect. But
so you'd have had a lawsuit even if it was the level 3 home as opposed to the level 1?
I don't know that I would have. If he had run from that level 3 home, they would have had a much stronger deliberate indifference argument. But that's not the same as talking about whether there was a state-created danger here, because here we have a shift from that level 3 to a level 1. And in order to adopt the state's position, you have to view the facts in a light most favorable to the defendants rather than the plaintiff. You have to narrow the context, not view it as a state custody case, and look at it only from the moment he was on the street to what they did next, as opposed to what the state had previously done and what they did next. Moreover,
counsel, it's sort of a one-way ratchet, the way you're describing it. If you ever go into state custody, you can only go up in terms of level of security, never down.
Not necessarily, Your Honor. If a child's behavior improves, and if the state could document that his behavior had improved, and that was the reason they changed his placement, that happens all the time. A child's behavior improves because his needs are addressed, and they lower the level of care. That never happened here because this.
I know your argument sounds to me a little bit like strict liability against the state if it doesn't fix what's wrong with the child.
No, Your Honor, it's a deliberate indifference standard. And of course, that's not really what we're talking about. That's undisputed in this case, that the state was deliberately indifferent to this child's needs. If there's a constitutional right, either under either theory, the culpability standard becomes deliberate indifference, which requires that the state know of a serious risk and ignore it. And that has been found in this case and has not been argued by the defendants on appeal. Under either theory, that would be the culpability standard, so it's not a strict liability standard. In fact, the standard has already been established in this case. So a state, if it tries really hard, that's what happened in Lentz versus Skipsky, is the state took certain steps and the children still had some harm. But the court found that there was no deliberate indifference because the state had made efforts. Here, the state didn't make efforts, and that issue is not before the court. So it's not strict liability. It's a state has a duty to take care of, at least address the needs it knows about. Things might still happen, but do something.
That sounds more like your failure to protect claim. I mean, I would prefer to separate the two because it's easy to go back and forth. I think one is certainly before us. The other one ordinarily wouldn't be before us. I know you want to tell us the same thing, but at least sounds to me more like your failure to protect claim the way you were describing it.
But the crux of the state created danger, if we just focus on that, is you could look at it the way the defendant wants to, but you could also look at it, a jury could look at it the way the plaintiffs are asking a jury to look at it, specifically the affirmative act of the state sitting down, making a placement decision to change him from a level 3 to a level 1. And their argument that they had nowhere else to put him. He was gone for a week. He'd run before. They also could have planned ahead. Their obligations didn't cease when he left the placement. They still had an obligation to him. They were still in loco parentis.
How would you just spell it out for me? How do you analyze the state-created danger claim factually?
I analyze it as this kid came into foster care as a runaway with gang affiliation. The only time they even addressed a runaway issue was to offer him payment for his AAU basketball if he didn't run away. That was the only thing that ever appeared. He ran again and again and again, got better at it and better at it and better at it. And they continued to take the affirmative act of placing him in level 1 placements, knowing he was going to run and declaring explicitly that if he ran, he would be hurt. specifically the final placement in a level three is the most egregious act that demonstrates a state-created danger. And that was a change from the state affirmatively from a level one to a level three. A jury might view it the way the state wants them to, but that is not a matter of law. That is a fact determination, and that can't be decided by this court.
All right. So we'll hear from, let's go, I'm sorry, go ahead, Judge White.
So you're saying that all these other state-created danger cases that we have don't apply. We should not follow their analysis because he was in state custody the whole time.
Yes, Your Honor, that affects the analysis. It changes the nature of these decisions that he was in state custody and the relationship was not a one-off interaction between a government official and a citizen. This was a custodial special relationship.
Okay.
All right. Your rebuttal, Ms. Bergmeier.
Your Honor's claimant has cited a case that is factually similar to the case you have before you today. When asked what cases were factually similar, he cites the Kahlstrom case, which you've already argued is factually dissimilar. He also cited to Littman, which is factually dissimilar. And in addition, it was decided in September 4th of 2020. It would not have put the defendants here on notice for their acts taken in April of 2017. The issue of whether there was a substantive due process violation due to the special relationship exception is not properly before this court. There was no notice of cross appeal filed on that issue.
Are those claims intertwined? Okay.
Those are two distinct exceptions to whether there's a substantive due process claim, and this court can decide the state created danger theory without touching on the special relationship theory. Finally, there's been a lot of allegations of what the defendant should have done, what duty they might have had to the child because he was in state custody. It is well established that due process clause does not transform any alleged tort committed by the state into a constitutional violation. And so we would submit that on either basis that we've argued, the defendants are entitled to qualified immunity on the state-created danger theory claim. Thank you, Your Honors.
We appreciate the argument both of you have given and we'll consider the case carefully.